to the Deco Retro program here on Planet FM. We will bring you interesting interviews, updates of future Deco, Modern, Retro, and other related events. Also the stories that celebrate New Zealand's history and its people, as well as book reviews and other snippets capturing the glamour and fascination of a bygone era.
Deco Retro, Deco Retro.
Good afternoon, listeners. This is Nancy on the Deco Retro program. In October 1909, a young 24-year-old hardware salesman, Robert Laidlaw, opened one of the first mail order businesses in New Zealand. No one in New Zealand was providing such a service, and Laidlaw, using mail order, could deliver a range of goods to customers at highly competitive prices compared to the existing retail stores. In a tiny 20 by 30 foot shop in the back streets of Auckland's commercial area, he invested the equivalent of a year's wages, about £125, in printing a 118-page catalogue that he had handwritten and illustrated. It was a risk, but Laidlaw believed he had spotted an opportunity in the market that others had overlooked. He posted catalogues to prospective customers in the rural areas of New Zealand. The choice of customer was important. From his experience as a travelling salesman, Laidlaw knew that country customers were at the mercy of general stores, who usually charged exorbitant prices. But there was little country customers could do about it. Isolated from the benefits of city shopping, they had little choice but to pay the premium prices and buy their goods on credit. The goods he sold were at wholesale prices, and his customers usually paid in advance in what we would now call lay-by, I suppose. He also offered the first money-back guarantee in New Zealand, giving customers the confidence to purchase using this new method of shopping. Location was important for a mail order business, and the Fort Street site gave him access to the city's port, central post office and main railway station. Because he demanded cash with orders, he had no bad debts and kept no stock. Business boomed, and 12 months later sees Laidlaw moving into an 18,000 square foot warehouse across from the original Fort Street location. He now employed 122 employees. The risk he had taken had paid off, and from these humble beginnings, the Farmers Trading Company was born. Today we have with us Edward Bennett from K Road Business Association. Edward was employed by the Farmers Trading Company from 1986 to 1989. Good afternoon, Edward. Lovely to have you with us once again.
Oh, thank you.
Now, I would like to open the program with some history on Robert Laidlaw. He was born in Scotland and came with his family to Dunedin in 1885. What do you know about Robert Laidlaw and his family, Edward?
Well, the Laidlaws were Plymouth Brethren.
Oh, okay.
Yes, they actually worshipped on Cranghappy Road in the hall on Howe Street. Mm-hmm. The Plymouth Brethren are a very austere Protestant denomination. Mm-hmm. They're one of the ones that are collectively known as the Puritans.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
A little bit different to the Exclusive, that's a...
Well, they're even more austere.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yes. So, they are extremely hardworking, mm-hmm. Moral, teetotalers, no gambling, no smoking, things like that.
Yes.
This was reflected in Robert Laidlaw's own business practices. Mm-hmm. He was one, they were very, people of that type were trusted by a lot of people in the marketplace that you could count on good quality products, and he was very good to his employees.
Yes, so I believed he helped out some of the people, you know, that had gone off to war, like soldiers of their families. He sort of would actually, you know, give them extra money and yes. their salaries to, you know, keep the family together and all that sort
That's
of thing.
That's right. And he always made sure that there was a job waiting for them when they got back.
Yeah.
And certainly when I started at Farmers in Hobson Street in the 1980s, there were quite a number of people down in the warehousing area that wouldn't have been employed anywhere else.
Yes.
There was pretty much of a sheltered workshop approach.
Okay.
You know, just people sweeping up, putting things in packages, putting things back on the shelves.
Were and they sort of disabled or?
Yes.
Well, that was good thinking, wasn't it?
Yes, you know, and it was a very interesting thing that there were these people in the warehousing area.
No, he obviously had a very kind heart and was very much a Christian.
Yes, and a substantial amount of his income actually went towards charities.
So I believe, yes, I've heard a bit about that.
Which, amongst other things, is why there's no great Laidlaw House on the landscape. He did not
believe in that.
No, he put money back into society, into charity, and into his employees.
I also read somewhere where he actually helped the government, gave the government money towards the war effort.
Yes,
because you know were we in the grip of a depression then? I mean, you know, the country was sort of very poor, and he actually, I thought at one stage, gave about £50,000 or something.
Which was a very, very, very large amount of money at that point. Yes.
To further the war effort.
Yes, that's right.
Yes. Why do you think the mail order business was so successful, you know, compared to, like, the big retailers who were around who were selling all the goods that, you know, people wanted? Why do you think the mail order thing worked?
Well, you were able to select things quite well from a mail order catalogue. He took as a model the large mail order companies in North America, including Sears Roebuck.
That's right. I think he sort of founded his business a bit on
He copied them very, very closely. And he succeeded in the same way that they succeeded. You had, as you said, a money-back guarantee. If when the item arrived, it wasn't suitable, you could send it back.
Yeah, which is, you know, quite good, really, isn't it?
It was very, very good.
Gave them people a lot of confidence.
Especially before the Second World War, people in the outlying areas of the country couldn't get around very easily. Most of the transportation up and down the country was by coastal shipping.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Even those people rich enough to afford a carriage couldn't go very far. So if you were a farmer, 80 miles outside of Whanganui, for example,
you were stuck there.
The shop, you know, you had your local shops, and then you might have once or twice a year a foray into the main centre. But those shops were still more expensive than, say, something here in Auckland or Wellington.
Yeah, and I think they fleeced their customers about those retail shops, didn't
they? Well, that was the thing. Laidlaw managed to root himself around that sort of thing. He wasn't the first person to do mail order. I mean, interestingly enough, Smith and Coe's had a very big Maori language mail order.
Gosh, that's interesting. In
the 19th century, it's very interesting. If you go into Smith and Coe's on Queen Street and you go upstairs, there's a staircase on the northern side of the shop, and there's a large poster in Maori from the 1870s. It's a reproduction.
Because they
understood that they were willing to take the time and effort to target Maori speakers in rural communities.
Good.
Laidlaw took it to an entirely new level, and he was specifically only mail order to begin with.
He had no shops anywhere, a long number of years.
So for almost a decade, he was not distracted by retail sales, per se. So whereas other people were doing mail order as an addition to their shop retailing, he concentrated very hard on mail order and made it an incredible success. Then he absorbed another company called the Farmers Trading Company and decided to keep that name because it had such a good name in the marketplace, and he was still specifically trying to target rural customers, i.e. farmers. So that's why he kept the name and changed it from Laidlaw Leeds to the Farmers Trading Company.
I believe he even sold like things like tractors and...
You could get anything.
Saddles and just about everything from, you know...
Even in 1986 when I started at Hobson Street, they still had a boat department and a saddle department.
And, I know, it's absolutely amazing.
Yes, it was sort of almost like a stock and station. Supplier.
Yes, absolutely amazing, his range of goods. Now, later on he had sort of built a car park, and all this was free, wasn't it? So that must have been a great help, like people would go park there, walk into the farmers and, you know, shop.
Well, it was an interesting thing. Once he decided to actually open a showroom, this actually was became a bit of a problem because his warehouse, the big warehouse that he'd built on Hobson Street in 1915, 1916, he managed to build there because it actually was not a retail area.
Oh, okay, in those days.
And so he had a warehouse there, and then he decided to have a showroom.
Yes.
And then discovered that actually people were not very keen to walk up the up Wyndham Street from Queen Street.
Right.
You know, so...
Yeah, because it's quite a steep up there. It's all uphill, isn't it?
And it is quite a steep hill. Again, he looked at what was happening in the big Chicago department stores.
Oh, so he modelled himself quite a lot on these American stores, department stores.
Modern American 20th century retailing. And a couple of the big Chicago stores had a free bus service collect customers and bring them.
That's a great incentive.
So that's what he did. He had a free bus coming up from Queen Street to Hobson Street.
Right.
And then he subsidised the tram company to have a tram system between Hobson Street and Crang Happy Road.
Gosh.
And then, after the Second World War, built a car parking building, one of the first high-rise car parking buildings in the country, and installed the first escalators.
That's right. That's right. That was quite amazing, wasn't it? Yes. Yes, I think people even went there just to ride the escalators.
Oh, they did indeed.
Lots of fun.
and that was the thing. People would come from all over the North Island. You know, every year or every two or three years, families would come up from the country and you would have to go to farmers, and it was part of the thing for the kids to ride the escalator. You know, it all helps.
That's right. Yes, lots of fun for those children. Now, at the top of the farmers, they had a tea rooms. And this was quite something, wasn't it? These tea rooms were, you know, very special. Customers went there. Can you tell us a bit about that, Edward?
Yes, well, it was one of the major developments of early 20th century retailing, partially through the work of Gordon Selfridge in London.
There
was recently the television program about his store in Oxford Street.
Of course,
The idea that you want to get people up into your building to the roof so they can look at the view, have a roof garden, tea rooms and a playground, because once the further up you get them in the building, the longer they take to trickle down and get out.
Oh, okay, good thinking.
And of course the electric lifts and the electric escalators help you with that.
Yes.
The longer they are in the building, the more likely they are to buy something.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So every department store in the world tried to get people from the street to the top of the building, and usually with tea rooms. Now, this is so much part of the normal shopping experience, it's difficult to understand when this actually did not exist. But women in the 18th and the 19th centuries did not tend to meet in town, have lunch and go shopping as a group.
No, it's too much of a...
It just did not occur to them.
They were too busy bringing their family up and whatnot.
But they would go shopping by themselves.
Oh, okay, yes.
The idea that you might organise with one of your friends, your girlfriends, to meet in town for lunch and then go and try frocks on and get each other's opinion.
Never existed.
It had not existed.
No, okay.
And so these shops created this ideal, and that's why you have the playground and the tea rooms at the top of the building, like at Farmers, with a nice view of the harbour.
Yes.
And women could organise to meet each other using the new electric telephone, come in on the electric tram, take the electric lift or the escalator to the top floor.
It was a real outing.
Yes, and it's all new, modern, clean and efficient, the new electric age. Everything beautifully lit by electricity. And then you can have lunch. And then you can try on outfits and get each other's opinions. Mm. And you do that again the following week or the following month. And that's when that came about. And again, it's difficult to understand when that was not the case.
Well, it was a really, obviously, a special thing to do. You talk to children. And yes, and the children played up there.
That's right. And if you give them somewhere to play, next to the toy department, lo and behold...
What happens?
You have to buy them something on the way out.
Exactly.
You see, this is why department stores grew so big and so prosperous.
Yes.
And why farmers had the most shops throughout the entire country. I think at one point they had 56 shops.
I know, it was a large number.
And of course, Hobson Street was 11 stories high.
Yes.
When I started there in 1986, it had something like 1,600 employees.
Gosh, that's quite a lot.
So that's probably about 600 shop staff, and the rest were accounts, administration and warehousing. Mm. So it was one of the largest concentrations in the country at that time.
Yes. And also there was a very special person, well, not person, but parrot up there.
A very special character, yes, Hector. Indeed, Hector had died about 6 years before I arrived.
Oh, dear, okay.
It was actually my job to dust him, just as it happens. Because no,
I was still there.
Yes. They stuffed him and put him in a cage, and they actually, heaven knows why, they actually put a small electronic recording so that you could press the button and he would say hello.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
And this is actually one of the reasons why I had to dust him, because most of the other shop assistants found him very, very morbid.
I can imagine, yes. Wouldn't be the best.
Apparently, he's still sitting in the lobby out at the farmer's headquarters in East Tamaki.
Yes, that's so I hear. He's there forever.
Apparently so.
Now, unfortunately, in I think it was the early 1980s, the Chase Corporation took over the farmers, and that was a disaster, wasn't it? It was terrible.
Yes, well, unfortunately, I was there when Chase took over. Basically, the farmers had become a public trading company, so there were shares on the open market.
Mm. It was big, wasn't it? It had a big turnover.
Yes, but, I mean, some companies never actually enter the public shareholding.
Oh, right, okay.
They're owned by one company or one family. Farmers had become a public company. And Chase bought up a whole lot of shares. And basically one morning we woke up to discover that over 51% belonged to the Chase Corporation.
That's interesting. So, like, the farmers had no control over that. You know, they were just taken over.
That's right.
That's frightening, isn't it?
Well, this happens time and again throughout, this is what they mean by a corporate takeover.
Ooh.
And people have to be very, very careful.
Mm.
You know that you, it's one thing to sell 30% or 40% of your shares on the public market, but you always want to retain 51%.
Exactly. So wonder they didn't do that. The farmers, you think they were bright enough?
I'm not sure how that happened, but over time, people sell shares, and one way or another,
you've got to get them back as a company, haven't
you? Right.
Yes.
The Chase Corporation were asset strippers.
Yeah, ghastly people, actually.
There were a number of corporations doing that in the 1980s, and basically they hived off the property into one property department, the retail company into another department, deliveries fleet into another company, and the manufacturing, because by that time farmers had their own shirt factory making Wyndham shirts, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant that we went from paying no rent to no longer owning the building in Hobson Street, and we had to pay rent.
Oh, for goodness sake. It's frightening, isn't it?
So it was amazing. All of a sudden, I mean, I was the head of jewellery at the time, and we went from having to sell, say, $40,000 a year at the time, to having to get close to 90,000.
Yeah, gosh.
Overnight.
To pay the rent and all the overheads. Yes.
That's right. Gosh. And, you know, I pointed out I would have to sell an $800 watch every 10 minutes.
Absolutely.
You know, you just could
just
not do that.
Just does not work. No.
And that's basically why the shop disappeared.
Yeah, and
it had less to do with customers not wanting to shop with us, less to do with our level of service or the quality of our products, mm-hmm. and more to do with the basic economic model had just been modified mm-hmm. until it was simply untenable. Chase itself went belly up.
Well, they actually didn't sort of own any buildings or land or anything, did they, in the country? They was purely had all their assets in the share market.
That's
which
right.
Which was all on paper, and it can collapse any time, can't it?
And it did. Mm. It's a very sobering period to analyse. That Farmers then was taken over, I think, by Woolworths, Decca as it was.
Yes.
And then finally purchased by the Norman family, who own Pascoe's.
Well, thank goodness, because they have actually brought it back too.
Indeed. Yes. Everything that I've been told, I stopped working for Farmers in 1990, everything I've been told, they're running it pretty close to what the Laidlaws were like. Very, very, very nice to hear.
Yes, well, they are that type of people, aren't
yes.
they? I mean, I think... of the Pascoe group,
mm-hmm.
and isn't Anne Norman a great-granddaughter of James Pascoe?
Yes,
so
like
they're
that.
Sort of that type of company there for the people, for their workers. And
well,
yeah.
that's what I hear, so all the more power to them.
Mm.
I mean, it was interesting, when I started there in 1985-86, as I said, there were about 1,600 employees. I was one of the last 10 people on the last day in 1990.
God grave.
It was amazing to see.
It would
see.
Be a sad day. It would be really sad.
It was incredible.
Yes.
It really was.
I'm just wondering, Edward, if you can recall, you know, you worked there for that number of years, any really funny or sad experiences you had there, just as a matter of interest to our listeners, you know?
Well, it was a funny thing. In the tea rooms at the top, there was a very big set of tea rooms for the staff. When I started there, there was an executive tea room.
Mm-hmm.
Where through the doors there was the special area.
Okay.
And by the last
were you
year,
into that? No.
by the time I became management,
yes.
There were so few staff at Hobson Street, we were all in one room.
Right.
And I remember one day going to the men's toilets, and I realised the corridor off the staff room actually went in two ways, and I found myself in this large billiard room with about 7 or 8 full-scale billiard tables.
Good grief.
Because that had been how many staff there
yes.
had been on that site.
Mm.
So that was quite amazing. The funniest thing that happened was probably one day I got back from lunch, and there was water everywhere. Somebody had been moving beds in the furniture department on the 10th floor just near the escalator bank. And they had smashed off one of the sprinklers from the fire system.
Oh, goodness me.
Directly over the escalator.
Gosh.
So the whole escalator bank, all 10.5 stories,
yes.
was just this waterfall.
Oh, no.
With all these people standing on this metal escalator that was still moving.
Oh, so they were all sort of covered in water. It was like
yes.
all over them. Oh my gosh, how embarrassing.
And how dangerous.
Yes, exactly.
So I mean, it was one of the things that just to show how well things like that are engineered. Because I mean, there was no possibility of electrocution. It was amazing to see this.
Yes.
You know, dozens of gallons of water cascading down a moving escalator with people going, oh my God, I'm standing on a metal
gosh.
Electric machine.
Oh yes. Gosh,
but
how terrible.
Nothing happened.
Nothing
happened.
It's
a great
that.
Testimony to modern engineering.
Well, gosh, that's absolutely...
That was one of the most funny and the most terrifying things I've ever seen in my life.
Wouldn't be the most nicest thing to have happened there. No. Well, Edward, look, thank you. It's been great, and I'm sure our listeners have really enjoyed it. We could go on for a lot longer, I'm sure, but unfortunately we're running short of time.
Thank you.
But thank you for being here today with us. Thank you, listeners. I hope you enjoyed that program with Edward today. Now we have Philippa with future events for Club Modern.
The Wurlitzer Organ Trust of Auckland have organised a concert on Sunday the 1st of September at 2 p.m. with Ken Double on the Allen TH300 Theatre Organ at the Playhouse Theatre in Glen Eden. Ken Double is from the US, where he is a celebrated performer of the mighty Wurlitzer Organ. He brings wit and humour along with his lyrical arrangements. As well as great music, the concert includes a silent movie comedy. So forget the winter blues and come along to the Playhouse Theatre, 15 Glendale Road, Glen Eden, on Sunday the 1st of September at 2 p.m. For all inquiries, phone 522-8944 or email jandenise@extra.co.nz. Jandenise, J-A-N-D-E-N-I-S-E @extra.co.nz. And just a footnote, Auckland's own mighty Wurlitzer is still in the process of being installed, but the completion date should be confirmed in the coming weeks. And that's all for me.
Listeners, to finish the program, we are going to bring two young Northland singers, Emma Cooper and Luke Bird, and they are going to sing Blue Smoke.
Program today, listen every second Wednesday of the month at 2:10 p.m. or download us anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/deco-retro. And we would like to thank our sponsors, Club Modern, Art Deco Society Auckland. We will keep you informed of all future exciting and glamorous events to be held by Club Modern. For more information, email judith.moore650@gmail.com. That's judith.moore650@gmail.com. Bye for now.